Okay, well, again, in reverse order, the speakers for the remainder of the afternoon, this is our last session in this symposium. The speakers in reverse order are Rose Carol Washington Long, who is Professor of Art History at the City University of New York and published on Kandinsky, Beckmann, Die Brucke, Photography in the Weimar Republic. Prior to that, Sarah McGavran, PhD candidate at Washington University in St. Louis, specializes in modern European art. And prior to that, Gregory Zinman. And Gregory is not here, but Gregory is going to be presenting to us via a slideshow with a voiceover. So over to you, Gregory. Marco, what is it? And will join us via Skype for the conversation at the end of this session. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Gregory Zinman, and today I'll be speaking about the legacy of Kandinsky's use of light in his experimental theater piece, The Yellow Sound, first published in the Blue Rider Almanac. My thanks to Joe Bradshaw and everyone at the Tate Modern for inviting me to participate in this conference and for being so accommodating. I'm very sorry that I could not attend in person, though I hope this virtual presentation will be of interest regardless. Describing the dramatic use of colored lights in The Yellow Sound, historian Peg Weiss writes that their overall effect was a, quote, veritable color light spectacle, end quote. The inclusion of the scenario for The Yellow Sound, as well as the essay Prometheus by A. Scriabin in the Blue Rider Almanac, speaks to a desire to find new correspondences between light play, form, and music, and opened up the cultural space for new forms of multimedia art. This paper examines four artists who heeded Kandinsky's implicit call to use light and time to create new forms of abstraction that would ring the inner sound by devising machines of their own artisanal design in order to create new kinds of abstract art in the medium of light. Before turning to my case studies, I want to establish some of the theoretical implications of Kandinsky's writing regarding the use of media. The Yellow Sound is an abstract one-act opera, conceived as a series of pictures. The piece calls for five yellow giants, a child, an adult, vague creatures, people in tights, other people in robes, an offstage tenor, and a chorus. While Kandinsky indicates certain notes to be played at certain times in the scenario, The Yellow Sound was written without recourse to a conventional score or libretto. Instead, the artist pays precise attention to the shifting color of light on the stage, and much less so to narrative or the development of character. He relies less on stage props or sets, and instead emphasizes the shifting play of light and color. His use of color in The Yellow Sound is mystical, symbolic, and related to the theories laid out in his earlier concerning the spiritual and art. The Yellow Sound, then, presents a radical reduction of theatrical elements. Props, costumes, and even people are reduced to pure light and movement. This reduction is developed through an argument regarding substitutions of media forms in another of Kandinsky's Blue Rider Almanac writings, the essay On the Question of Form. There, Kandinsky argues that while artworks take different forms, they harbor similar intentions and work on the viewer or auditor's sensual and emotional perceptual apparatus in similar ways. He consequently asserts that a drawing, a musical note, or a snippet of poetry can all provoke the same response in the beholder, so that color, for instance, can duplicate the effects of music, or light, the effects of painting. Form is always temporal, i.e. relative, for it is nothing more than the means necessary today through which the present revelation makes itself heard. Therefore, we should not look for salvation in one form only. There may be many different forms at the same time that are equally good. Although Kandinsky's conceptual theater work is often considered under the rubric of media synthesis, many details in his writing also points to the way in which his conception of sound, movement, and color can be understood as intermedia. In 1966, Fluxus artist Dick Higgins coined the term intermedia to describe the dialectical interplay between media, which Higgins dubbed, quote, arbitrary, and classifications that, quote, have become merely puristic points of reference, end quote. Higgins' conception of intermedia is not the totalizing synthesis of the Gesamtkunstwerk, but rather a means of describing works that exist between accepted artistic practices. Intermedia works are hybrid rather than synthetic, and are marked by the aesthetic and philosophical tensions that result from the juxtaposition of their various techniques and materials, or by the recontextualizing of one kind of media among other kind of media. Higgins hoped that these new techniques and technologies would, in turn, foster radical and immediate forms of communication that would promote sociality and understanding. Kandinsky's combinations of movement, sound, and color in The Yellow Sound are potentially limitless and can be used not only to establish a series of correspondences, but contrapuntal tensions as well. By establishing a complex matrix of correspondences, substitutions, and contrapuntal programming, Kandinsky believed that he could achieve a, quote, deeper inner impact, end quote, of synesthetic response in his audience. This interplay of media forms can be seen in several artists who, following Kandinsky, sought to combine color, light, and time in new ways. A key figure in establishing an intermedial history of devices devised to shift light and time is Danish-born inventor and singer Thomas Wilfred. Wilfred believed he had created the eighth art, which he dubbed Lumia, or compositions of light in time. Quote, the artist's sole medium of expression is light, end quote, he wrote in 1947. A piecemeal transcendentalist, Wilfred sought to represent what he called, quote, the universal rhythmic flow in his art, and produced roughly 40 works before his death in 1968. At present, only 18 of his Lumia compositions survive, and even fewer are operational. He employed reflective mirrors, hand-painted glass discs, and bent pieces of metal, all housed in a wooden cabinet, or in one case mounted on a walnut tea wagon, to transform beams of light produced by a series of lamps and lenses. Wilfred performed and displayed his work in a variety of settings, from the 1934 World's Fair to Carnegie Hall to a department store in Ohio. In 1958 and 1959, different Lumia compositions were on view at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Whitney Museum of American Art, and the Museum of Modern Art. At various times, Wilfred conceived of using Lumia for theater design, for recitals in light, as home entertainment systems, as fine art objects, and even as medical devices that could help soothe women going into labor or pacify those engaging in psychotherapy. Here we have Wilfred's silent Opus 161 from 1965 and 66, a Lumia composition of light and time. The piece runs without repeating for 1 year, 315 days, and 12 hours. Wilfred said of the length of his Lumia compositions, quote, I consider these works as closed sequences without beginning or end, to be enjoyed at any point and for any length of time, like phenomena in nature, end quote. Wilfred's investigations into light were partially motivated by his belief in theosophy, a pluralistic 19th century system of metaphysics, wherein each religion plays a part in constructing a universal truth that would perfect humanity via the continual development of higher consciousness. Wilfred held that Lumia could be linked to a collective cosmic consciousness, and that such consciousness spoke to or even revealed some sort of universal rhythm. He was also deeply influenced by fellow theosophist Kandinsky's writings on abstraction. He believed that Lumia was not only a new art, but one that would set the stage for a great leap forward in human creativity. Lumia even came to represent a kind of eschatology for Wilfred, a key to mental transcendence in a time of apocalypse, and, echoing Kandinsky's writing in Concerning the Spiritual of Art, a heralding of a new age of spiritual enlightenment. Quote, its medium is light, he wrote. Quote, the silent universal manifestation of the greatest forces our senses can grasp. It is not unreasonable to expect that Lumia may become the symbol of the dawn, of mankind's approaching maturity, even if it can only be the chastened survivors of a final atomic rampage, end quote. Though he made his first device as early as 1905, By 1921, Wilfred had realized his first full-fledged light instrument, the clavillox, a far more elaborate and intricate color organ, capable of producing works of extreme variety and intensity. The clavillox apparatus is concealed in a wooden housing and uses a reflective mirror and bent pieces of metal to shape light thrown by a series of lamps and lenses. A series of projectors then cast images onto a screen or surface. The clavillox player controls the desired hues and shapes via a piano-like keyboard. The results are slowly morphing apparitions of shifting form and vibrant color, an inner mounting flame of smoky brilliance. If Wilfred's explanations and proclamations regarding his eighth art were filled with brio, his critics had a more difficult time finding the words to accurately describe or even qualify what they had seen. Kenneth Peacock, for one, has noted that the aurora borealis was a common point of comparison for writers discussing Lumia. Covering a Wilfred recital for the New York World in December 1924, critic Deems Taylor wrote, quote, "The fact that Thomas Wilfred's clavillox is commonly known as the color organ is not the only reason why a music reviewer should have attended his recital last night at Aeolian Hall. For this new color art might very aptly be called music for the eye. It is color and light and form and motion, but it is not painting, nor sculpture, nor pantomime. It's difficult to convey in words. Describing the clavillox to one who has not seen it is like describing an orange to an Eskimo." End quote. Taylor identifies Lumia as, quote, "this new color art," end quote, and adopts the visual music language of music for the eye, but ultimately he can resort to a description of only what it is not. Nevertheless, his words raise the intermedial question of how to appropriately classify works that lack historical conventions or understanding, as well as the media juxtapositions and substitutions first detailed by Kandinsky. By 1930, Wilfred had developed a self-playing home version of the device, dubbed the Clavillox Jr., which was housed in a television-type walnut cabinet with Art Deco steel hinges, and which was intended to act as a personal light projection display. 14 of these junior models were made. They consisted of 100-watt moving lamps, two reflecting cones, and a series of changeable glass discs, or color records, that were numbered as individual opus compositions. The Clavillox Jr. also featured a keyboard with which the home viewer could add or remove elements from the display, as well as control the unit's tempo, shutter, and three small floodlights. Wilfred eventually designed and built larger self-playing standalone units for Lumia displays in museums. These automatic Lumia devices were capable of delivering pieces of extremely long duration and variety. Stephen X. Gilson argues that even as Wilfred strove to establish Lumia as an independent art, he was not so dogmatic as to resist using analogies to other arts in order to introduce himself to a wider audience. For instance, Wilfred utilized a musical vocabulary, such as scores, notations, keys, and stops, to describe both his instruments and his scripted performance scenarios. By 1942, the Museum of Modern Art had purchased Wilfred's vertical sequence, Opus 137, and 10 years later, he was featured in the museum's contemporary survey, 15 Americans, alongside abstract painters Mark Rothko, Jackson Pollock, and Clifford Still. Wilfred's statement in the exhibition catalog couches his work in terms often associated with abstract expressionism, as well as cinema. Quote, "The Lumia artist visualizes his composition as a drama of moving form and color unfolding in dark space. In order to share his vision with others, he must materialize it. This he does by executing it in a two-dimensional sequence projected on a flat white screen." Curiously, MoMA continues to classify its three Lumia pieces as paintings. In the quote you just heard, in addition to the abstract expressionist ideas about drama and color, Wilfred describes his work in terms of moving form, enfolding in space, and projection on a screen. So here again is evidence of a conception of art whose intermedia components describe the play between media or works occurring between accepted artistic practices. At the same time that Wilfred was developing his clavillox, Bauhaus students Ludwig Hirschfeld-Mack, Josef Hartwig, and Kurt Schwertweger were realizing their instructor Moholy-Nagy's dream of painting in light through the construction of hand-manipulated color organs, played by up to four people at once to project layered, full-color moving geometric forms onto a transparent screen. These multiplayer color devices used a series of movable stencils and 6 to 8 projectors with variable light intensity to create live performances that represent some of the first intermedia experiments. The pieces were scored like music, rehearsed in the mode of theater and were called plays, and experienced as a kind of abstract cinema. Here's a sample of a recreation of Schwarzenegger's reflecting color light play of 1922, made shortly after his death in 1966. Hirschfeld Mack and Schwarzenegger were students of Oskar Schemmler, the director of the Bauhaus Stage Workshop, who had utilized film projections as theatrical backdrops. As with Kandinsky, the Bauhaus's radical reduction and abstraction of theatrical lighting stemmed from developments in late 19th and early 20th century stagecraft. The years 1880 to 1885 saw changes in theatrical lighting due to the advent of electricity. Swiss architect Adolphe Appia was a leading theorist of stage lighting, designing much of the scenery for Wagner's operas. He asserted that drama was produced by rhythmic use of space, and that space was best created by moving light, which added a sense of three-dimensionality to sets. Another innovator was British actor, producer, and lighting designer Edward Gordon Craig, who developed a system of theatrical lighting with mobile screens. Craig was interested in color theory and eschewed traditional footlights for ones hung high above the stage. Quote, "The only true material for the art of theater is light," he wrote, "and by means of light, movement," end quote. Hirschfeld Mack extended these principles to his color light plays, performing Sonata II, Red, with Hartwig and Schwarzenegger at the Bauhaus Festival in 1923. He wrote a musical accompaniment for organ in D minor, and wrote in the piece's score that his aim was to, quote, "intensify rhythm and musical relationships in the non-time-based picture into a real, continuous movement," end quote. As with Kandinsky, Hirschfeld Mack, Hartwig, and Schwarzenegger were seeking to exceed the visual possibilities of painting through movement and time. In his first Bauhaus book, 1925's Painting, Photography, and Film, Moholy wrote on the implicit movement in abstract art, quote, "Take a work by Kandinsky or Clay. Here are all the elements for real movement are present. Tensions between surfaces and space, rhythm and musical relations, all in a non-time-based picture," end quote. Similarly, he wrote in Vision in Motion, quote, "Abstract painting can be understood as an arrested, frozen phase of the kinetic light display, leading back to the original emotional, sensuous meaning of color in which William Turner, the great English painter, was an admirable predecessor," end quote. Once again, the immaterial medium of light is taken here to represent a certain solidity, a realness denied to abstract painting. That these media efforts are related to the project of abstract painting is further evinced by the fact that Kandinsky showed images of Hirschfeld Mack's work at a lecture in Leipzig. Kandinsky, notably, had himself designed colored light projections to accompany a 1928 performance of Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition in Dresden. Reviewing the performance, Ludwig Grote observed that the stage setting seemed to animate Kandinsky's signature abstractions and make them even more like music than his paintings. He further praised Kandinsky in comparison to his contemporaries. Quote, "Kandinsky has penetrated deeper into the new territory than Laszlo and Hirschfeld Mack have been able to. Their previous works gave no indication of such a wealth of expression. The shapes appeared only as surfaces. The stage area with the black background and the lighting came across as quite unreal, like the space in Kandinsky's paintings. Alongside the movement of the shapes, the lighting appears as a time moment and gives a wide-ranging and rich scale of tone intensity." A final and more recent example of Kandinsky's legacy of intermedial light play can be seen in the work of video artist Stephen Beck. In 1968 and 69, as a freshman at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, equally influenced by Kandinsky's painting, Wilfred's Lumia, Oscar Fischinger's Ludic Animations, and Jordan Belson's Cosmic Cinema, the 18-year-old electrical engineering student was inspired to create a new kind of color organ, a personal visual instrument that would take advantage of new technology to achieve new optical effects. By 1970, Beck was fortunate enough to be the recipient of a donated 27-inch color Zenith television. He immediately set to work on modifying the red, green, and blue video circuits of the set. Inspired by Bob Moog's audio synthesizers, which became a favored instrument of forward-thinking rock bands of the era, Beck also began building an analog video console. These pieces comprised the first Beck video synthesizer, quote, capable of real-time, full-color video with motion, shading, textures, and forms, based on my invention of the voltage-to-position converter circuit for horizontal and vertical locations, end quote. In addition, Beck could feed audio signals into his colorizer to create images in real-time. Excited by his invention, he began holding informal get-togethers at his apartment. These video salons usually consisted of a dozen or so friends and colleagues playing records by Mozart, Pink Floyd, The Beatles, and Stockhausen, with Beck routing the audio into his synthesizer, quote, which produced amazing, never-before-seen images on the color screen, end quote. While Beck would go on to modify his video instruments, developing an increased mastery in his ability to shape color, texture, form, and motion, he also embraced the idea of participating in real-time performance with his personal visual instrument, much in the manner of Wilfred and the Bauhaus light artists. Beck demonstrated these capabilities by collaborating with musicians and other artists in live concert settings, live-to-tape television performances, and meticulously conceived video pieces such as Union from 1975, which concerns the reconciliation and joining together of the bodily and the spiritual. Beck's work not only serves as a new media instantiation of color's ability to transmit one's inner sound, he also sought to place himself in a formal and theoretical tradition stemming from Kandinsky, saying, quote, he's the painter who has influenced my own thinking the most. I think this ties my video into a tradition with the arts, the non-objective tradition. On the Spiritual and Art is really a masterpiece of someone putting down in words what the experience is about. I had experiences of seeing the visual field break down into elements, and when I was doing the design for the synthesizer, I structured these elements, color, shape, texture, and motion, and I further took the element of shape into subcategories of point, line, plane, and illusion of space. And so again we see a substitution of media, here from painting to video, to achieve common goals of depicting inner realities via abstraction. Indeed, Beck viewed his direct video synthesizer as a means to exploit what he saw as, quote, the inherent plasticity of the medium, to expand it beyond a strictly photographic, realistic, representational aspect, end quote. Furthermore, he wished to stress that imagery could not just be mediated by video technology, but that video images could be created that bore the artisanal style of their creator, ones that, quote, are a direct result of the circuitry and design of the instrument, end quote, and that video instruments could be designed to engender specific psychological responses in the viewer. In conclusion, I hope that my exploration of intermedial forms of light art demonstrates Kandinsky's belief in the relationship between media forms, finding common ground between the color organ and the theater, as well as among the forms of light art, abstract cinema, and video art. Today, we can see traces of the yellow sound in elements of projection performance, VJ culture, and the renewed interest in the history and practice of the psychedelic light show. My aim has been to build a framework through which to explore how formal and aesthetic concerns are shared by these varied modes of the moving image. The status of these works as intermedia, neither solely painting, performance, movie, or sculpture, should not discourage us from exploring their relationship to one another, and should instead be considered an invitation to review this art with new eyes and to rethink the shifting boundaries of artistic practice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to have a break now, and we'll resume at 25 minutes past three.